Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books and Indian Religions podcast here on the New Books Network. This podcast probably will be cross-posted to all religion channels because of the impact of the guest whom I have the pleasure of welcoming back to the podcast, Dr. Russell T. McCutcheon, who is a university research professor and for 18 years was the chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Alabama. We'll be talking about a second edition of a seminal volume of papers in the field called Critics, Not Caretakers, Redescribing the Public Study of Religion. Russ, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks for having me back, Raj. This is great.
So tell us a little bit about the impetus behind Critics, Not Caretakers. What was going on at the time why was this timely? What was happening in the field?
Well, the first edition came out in 2001, and it was my second book. It was a collection of essays. I didn't plan to be an essayist, but I, for a variety of reasons, you know, I could go into later if you want, I kind of became an essayist. And many of the papers that were pulled together for that, SUNY published the first edition, Routledge published this new one, were being written right when I was finishing the manuscript for what was my first book, Manufacturing Religion, which is a revised version of my dissertation that I did at Toronto. So at the time of that book, I think one of the challenges for anybody who's writing is, when are you adding to the current project and when are you starting a new project? And often these things, if you have certain coherent sets of interests or what developed to be, they kind of merge into each other. So I'm writing these pieces at the same time as finishing that book manuscript. So the pieces, the original publication, are all from the kind of 95, 96, 97, 98. These are essays that I'm writing and publishing in a variety of journals. Some of the pieces in the first edition were new to that edition, but a lot of them had appeared in journals. And the occasion for writing all of them, and maybe this is why I became an essayist in some ways, I'm tenure track. I'm a new recent hire at the Southwest Missouri State, what they called it at the time, was I would read things, given the views that I had on the field that came out in the first book, I'd read things in journals that would really frustrate me. Like I'd read this essay in the Journal of Religion or the Journal of the American Academy, these standard publications in the study of religion that struck me as not in any way representing what I thought the study of religion was, ought to be, should be, etc. And I was full of piss and vinegar then, as the old saying goes. And so I would write these unsolicited replies and commentaries, and I would send them to the journal. And they were rejected at times. At times they were published. At times they started a reply response, which is, I love that part of journals when journals do that. The original author gets the last word. A few of the pieces were not written that way. A few of the pieces were just frustrations over current issues at that time in the field. And so I wrote an essay and submitted it. One of the pieces that appeared in that collection on public intellectuals, a couple of faculty reply to it themselves in JAR, and I got a chance for a response. And at the time, I guess my voice was sufficiently novel in the field that the reply responses at times had some sparks to them, shall we say, a thing that we don't necessarily see that much of in the field. I think because a lot of people think, you know, the study of religion is about studying certain kinds of things, and we need certain kind of disposition to do that. And so our exchanges and disagreements tend to be very cordial at times. And so these had a fair bit of sparks. And so I'm an early career academic, and I kind of landed on the scene with a certain kind of reputation, it seems. So that's where this book came from.
They're critics, not caretakers. I mean, very telling and a descriptive title. But what is the gist of the publication? Many of our listeners will be generalists or members of the public. So what's the thrust of what the book is accomplishing?
The title came from Burton Mack, who passed away not too long ago, a very influential, though within a limited area, and I can talk about that in a moment, scholar of Christian origin. So not just New Testament, though he wrote on the New Testament as a scholar, but also interested in the social world from out of which this thing that we eventually come to know as Christianity arose. So we can't really use the text to account for that because the text was itself a product of that world. So how can we say some things about the factors in the Greco-Roman world that might have led to this social group forming? So in a 1989 paper of his that he gave at a public lecture at Wesleyan College, University, that wasn't published until quite some time later, he uses this phrase that we ought to be, as scholars, culture critics and not caretakers for the phenomenon being studied. And so that's where I'm picking that up. And I try to credit Bert directly in the book. So the argument of the book is that the style of scholarship that is often represented in the study of religion is a form of scholarship that, on a continuum, of course, presumes its object of study is some sort of special object that must be treated carefully and cared for, as opposed to seeing it as representative of a certain social milieu, a historical time, evidence of certain economic and political phenomena happening at the time, as opposed to seeing those just as the stage onto which this special object is projected, expressed, manifested, embodied. We have many words over time that we've used to talk about that two-stage process. Two-stage, the inner pristine feeling, experience, affectation that is only secondarily put out into the world. And thus we find people talking about how history and context shapes the expression. They will never say causes. In other words, it's not a thorough, rigorous, thoroughgoing historicization of the things we study, that these are interesting, of course, but historical, social phenomena that can be studied like anything else. The one route Burton Mack calls caretaking for the object of study, and the other route he calls being a culture critic, which those who disagree with that position will quickly, I'll just be frank, caricature as you're criticizing the people you study, and you're being mean and a poor guest in their social worlds, which it strikes me that that's not what this is about in any way, shape, or form. But the title, I decided on it, you know, to be purposely provocative, to kind of make the point that we're not here to ensure the well-being of the thing we study. We're here to study it as scholars and to place it into history, determine its causes, etc.
Do you feel that that has changed? How would you characterize the relationship between caretakers versus critics among scholars of religion, at least in your particular research or observation since then?
The challenge of a second edition, you know, why do this? And my rationale in talking to the press that acquired the rights from the first publisher was that I don't think much has changed at all. So the book's main essays, there's a new essay at the front end, but it's all the original essays, slightly updated, but I'll tell you about the other updating in a moment. They're all presented pretty much as they appeared in the original edition, because I think, you know, I don't want to sound pompous here, but I just think the book has a historical quality. It's a snapshot of the late 20th century field commenting on things that were happening in the 60s and 70s and 80s, but that were really happening in the 90s. And the interesting thing, lamentable thing, you know, what word will we put in there, is that I don't think much has changed at all. That the field is largely still comprised, I would argue, of people who, for probably very good reasons, they think, are interested in a style of scholarship that, in the parlance of the book, cares for, supports, preserves the items that they happen to be studying. Should one study things with which one disagrees? I don't want to be so flippant here, but I mean, I can picture all kinds of things that scholars legitimately study that you would immediately understand your role is to explain it, account for it, place it into a historical context. In no way, shape, or form are you here to treat it carefully. And should you do that, you would a series of accusations would greet you along a spectrum from being a traitor to who knows what all. And so I'm not looking for a style of scholarship that, you know, makes fun of, criticizes, but I am looking for an equity of treatment across the things we study, regardless our own individual sentiments toward it, that we really probably don't need two styles of scholarship, one for things we support or you know, I'm riffing on Bruce Lincoln here, a scholar of religion formerly in Chicago, things for which we have a feeling of affinity versus those things from which we're estranged. We probably need to figure out how to treat them equitably. So the second edition seemed an opportunity to make the argument that we're not past these issues. A lot of people in the field, I think you will hear people say we're post-theory. Yes, we understand all the problems of the category of religion, and now we just need to get on with studying it. And I don't think that's not really very persuasive to me. So the way to update the book, it struck me with all that in mind, was to write new introductions to all the pieces to say, well, this chapter is locked in a debate from 1997, but I think it's surprisingly relevant to what's going on today. The players have changed. Some of the terms have changed, but it's the same debate still happening. And I don't think anything has been really resolved.
From what you could observe or surmise or suspect, would you say that this phenomenon is applies to various traditions, for example, Christian studies versus Hindu studies versus Buddhist studies? Would you say that there are particular strands of scholarship or traditions that are more vulnerable to this pitfall? Or could you characterize, could you comment on that at all?
Yeah, I don't know. That's an interesting question. I think one of the challenges in our field, and I've never really considered our field an area study. You know, I just did air quotes as I said that. But a lot of people do, and maybe it ought to be considered that. The challenge of a lot of fields is that for very good reason, people with either feelings of affinity, familiarity, whatever one wants to say for the items being studied are drawn to study them. Or conversely, people with strong feelings of resentment and reaction too are drawn to study. You know, maybe we find that also in chemistry. I don't know, but certainly in our part of the university, we can find that. So the inducements, temptations in a lot of different fields to developing a bit of a two-tiered approach to how we study our material, it's very present across fields. Within our part of the university, the academic study of religion, I think it's very common to find strong tendencies to grant the ground rules of the item of study and simply work within those two in a classic interpretive method to understand it the right way, to interpret it better, thereby placing one often within a series of participant debates that have long existed about that exact thing, how best to understand this behavior, this group, this text. And thus a challenge, I think, to an interpretive model of the field, which is still, I think, dominant in the field. The presumption that there is a meaning somehow locked in the item And if we just read it the right way, study it the right way, approach it the right way, we can somehow ascertain that meaning. For those who have gone through the intentional fallacy, the death of the author, you can imagine real challenges they would have with that whole approach to the field without such critics, let's call them now critics, ever going down the road of a rigorous, naturalistic, scientific reduction of it. You know, they'll certainly be kind of an anti-hermeneutical model they'll adopt. So we can even bracket that classic natural science critique, go there if we want, but we're not even necessarily going there to find a problem with that dominant model that all too often, I think, to go back to what I said, conserves a certain kind of logic or grammar of the item that many of its own participants and users presume from the outset.
Mm. So regarding the subtitle of the book, which of course has been retained in the second edition, we're describing the public study of religion. What do you mean by public study of religion? Say a bit about that.
All my career, I've been trained in and worked in public universities. So that's certainly a subtext, especially coming to the U.S. For a career I didn't plan to come here. And like a lot of people, a career luckily happened for me, and it was in the U.S. So there's obviously the private-public distinction in colleges, whether, you know, major research universities or small liberal arts colleges that, you know, might be denominationally affiliated, maybe not. So the argument for a style of scholarship on religion that I'm supporting, along with many others, but I do think we're not in the majority. In the U.S. context, which is where I was writing from and working, that seemed to be a very useful way to frame the debate. That if we're engaging in a publicly funded exercise where our constituency, our students, the so-called publics to which we were accountable are diverse, varied, not uniformly interested in, especially given the way our field can be practiced in other domains, not necessarily interested in producing religious functionaries or theologians in certain, you know, there's many schools that is their mission. So that struck me as a way of framing the issue that would have potential effect in my own setting. It's not, I think, a universally relevant way of framing it. You know, that's not necessarily how the debate has been framed in Europe for many years, the private-public distinction. I'm not, you know, a constitutional scholar, but there's certain American implications for how things are engaged in public, what can be taught in a grade 11 science classroom, what can't be. So I think the way that argument to support the same style of scholarship for which I'm advocating takes shape in a Canadian context, in a British context, in a German context, will probably all vary based on certain national sets of assumptions about how educational systems work. You know, in some European settings, state funding finances religious education in schools, which is a theological exercise, you know, perhaps. So it will take different shapes, but that was very much catered to the kind of world that I was living and working in at the time and still am.
Let's pan out a little bit. 30,000 foot view, you know, the world that we're in, the field that we're engaged in. What do you see, perhaps, or how would you characterize, broad strokes, the value of religious studies and what we're doing? Or post-Reformation and the way, imagine we're doing it the way you think we should be doing it, you know, where does that fit in? Like, what is the application and value of that in your perspective?
That, my good man, is a $50,000 question, right?
Maybe 50 million.
Yes. In today's higher ed environment, in almost any national setting, the attacks on the humanities, I think attack is not too strong a word, whatever we want to call this, that sooner or later, the lens comes around to, the conversation comes around to, value. Now, how we define that value, that's going to cut a lot of different ways. And thus we arrive at many defenses of the humanities today, of which the academic study of religion is often on my own campus, we're in the humanities. Though I would advocate for practicing it in almost a social scientific kind of way, but let's bracket that, you know, debate and put that aside for the time being. Often defenses of the humanities will bristle at the so-called instrumentalization of the humanities, and that the only way to talk about the value of the humanities, or so some would push back, is by seeing them as career training, as having direct job application. I wouldn't want to go down that road for a variety of reasons when talking about the value. Conversely, it's not difficult to find, certainly in historical materials. Just this morning, I was searching around. I found an article from a conference at the University of Tennessee in 1945 on the instrumental value of the humanities. Like, those debates have not come from nowhere. But I wouldn't want to go down the opposite road that exalts the, you know, let's offer the caricature of the tweed-coated poetry professor or class sitting on the quadrangle's lawn reading something, and it's on like this kind of utterly disconnected from the practical dictates of life. I'm not going to go down that road either. So what do we mean by value? My own presumption is that our students, and by students, I guess I'm meaning our majors and minors, the one we mostly teach here in the US with core curricula or gen ed, there's so many of our students that we teach who will never take another course. They're taking a breadth requirement service, one class, the business student, the engineering student, the nursing, social work student to satisfy a requirement. So I think that's one conversation about value to them that we can have. But for the time being, the majors who take many courses, you know, they're going to have to feed themselves and pay bills when they graduate. So I can't be unaware of that. So for me, the value question is answered with them in mind. And I find our students among the most interesting students because they don't have a preset formula put in front of them on day one of their undergrad. They don't know what they're going to take in their third semester, their fifth semester, their eighth. And not to criticize students in professional schools, but it's very much laid out for them. They know exactly what they're taking. Our students, I think, are very interesting students because they're deeply involved in self-invention along the way. And so the value of what we're giving them, unless they have a direct job application or a career goal related to the object of study itself, this text they might have studied, that group, the value that we're giving to them, I'm going to use the E word, entrepreneur. We're helping them to become entrepreneurial problem solvers. And I don't mean that in a classic business sense, right? And I tend to think that the lives that are going to be presented to them a year out of our classroom, 10 years out of our classroom, you know, whatever, if my own life, and I'm guessing yours too, is any measure, it's a life of thinking on your feet, adapting to situations, looking for opportunities, solving problems, slamming headlong into something that's way bigger than you and retreating and trying to figure out how to deal with it. And a lot of the humanities, I think, provide that for students. In the study of religion, I think, given the strong investments a lot of people put in their own lives on the things we happen to study in our field, positions us really well to develop students who are very articulate in dealing with potentially high-stakes situations where there probably is no clear answer, and they've got to navigate this somehow, figure this out, and they have to deal with people in some way that can get them to this new place they want to get to, whatever their goal is. And so in a whole variety of places, I think we, and I think I have a better argument for that, you know, in my department chair life that I formerly had, when you have to actually come up with, you know, flyers. But at the end of the day, I think that's what we're giving our students. It's not necessarily the content. For some of them, it will be. I really love studying this this Quranic text, or I really, I just want the Bhagavad Gita, really, and I just want to study that. Great. But for so many of them, I think the objects of study, the data, the content, and this is where I'm very much with Jonathan Smith, is kind of arbitrary. It's an opportunity and a site to do all these other things, interpretation, description, analysis, whether it's interpretive or explanatory, to figure out new ways of talking about the world that we had not seen before. That's the value I think we give. If I'm in a meeting with, you know, the dean of engineering, I'll probably try to figure out some more pragmatic things to say, given my setting, like the public subtitle, given my setting. But at the end of the day, we're helping students to be articulate problem solvers who know it's not going to be done for them. That's kind of how culture works. We're all doing this. What their sets of interests are, where they want this to go, I don't know. That's going to be different for each of them. But I think we're giving them tools for intellectual self-defense. How's that?
That's fascinating. Thank you for indulging the 30,000 foot view question, framed, of course, within the context of undergraduate teaching. Where my mind goes, because it's pertinent to something else I happen to know that you're working on, is what about grad students? What about their role? What are your experiences and innovations in that training and what that looks like? And feel most free to talk about the current project that you have on hand as well.
I hope it's not too loud. I have a leaf blower outside I'm on a third floor, but I hear that buzzing out there. It takes a lot of work to make a campus look pretty. we talked briefly about this once before, that you were kind enough to write a foreword for the book. It's like an edited book that'll come out in 2024 with Equinox in the UK, but you know, available here in North America. On trying to move the needle a little bit, move the field a little bit in the direction of thinking of back to value, right? Entertaining that graduate education, until something changes, and that something is international economies, national funding priorities, taxation, this is a very big set of issues. So that, you know, aircraft carrier, that cruise ship isn't going to turn around overnight. Until that happens, to figure out ways of training graduate students in our field, let alone the rest of the humanities, for much wider careers than professorships. Because we all know, and that's the problem, right? We all know that I don't want to be the bearer of bad news. You know, spoilers, Doctor Who, if you're a grad student not paying attention to this, like we all know that the vast majority of graduate students will not become professors, that the jobs are not there, the funding is not there, attrition is happening in many units, retirements are not being replaced, so attrition. Funding is largely going to professional schools. Moms and dads and students are wisely cognizant of what will you do after you get this degree, especially depending where you're going to school, the cost of these degrees. Well, it's going up everywhere, but it's exorbitant in some places, maybe more middle class affordable in others, but it's still going up. So in that context, not of our making, why aren't doctoral programs especially? Because that was the degree preparing people for professorships traditionally. Why aren't they adapting to this? And it strikes me that there's two ways of adapting. You know, either you cut your enrollment, you know, that's one way, or you retool the entire program, curricula, what counts as a dissertation. And again, not for job training, but to help empower the students who want to acquire these thick research skills, deep dive into some item that they wish to study, to equip them to do something when they graduate other than scramble and self-invent themselves. And, you know, my hat's off. You always got to say these things the right way to the ones who have done that. There's a degree of bootstrap pulling up that tons of doctoral students who successfully finish their programs and are quite successful in the use of research skills have had to do for the last 15 years, 20 years, 30 years, none of these problems came overnight. Certainly heightened dramatically by the post-2008 mortgage bubble collapse. Yes, heightened even more. Height is the wrong metaphor. We should talk about cliffs falling off of if you look at the employment graphs, right? After COVID budget cuts, yes, heightened dramatically, but none of these things come as a surprise. And they've the successes that they've had, I think if you were to talk to many, and we've talked about your trajectory, I think many students are very happy they did a PhD, many graduates, but they know that they had to do this on their own and their program wasn't part of that reinvention. And reinvention is now the wrong word to use, right? From the get-go, what are the wide application and diversity of careers that advanced research skills can be put to? So the book is about that. It's a collection of essays. The anchor piece is a piece that I was involved in co-writing with four other people. One, my colleague here, Vaya Tuna, but three others, doctoral graduates who have each reinvented themselves, recent doctoral graduates, so not my generation, and then getting a variety of people in positions of responsibility in current graduate programs in America to reply to them. I asked a number of people, a number of programs, I'm not going to name them, but a number were too busy to take the project on. And I just thought that's kind of part of our problem, that I don't want to say our house is on fire, but our house is kind of on fire. And if we can't, in probably rather short order, figure out how doctoral programs in the study of religion can continue to train students in important skills by offering them a significant leg up on a variety of futures where they can put those skills to use. Do we need internships in doctoral programs? Like, start thinking very creatively. If we can't do that, like daily I hear of a new small liberal arts or public university program losing its major, being combined with, you know, history and philosophy or modern languages. So any problem placing doctoral students now into professor positions, as challenging as it is, it's just going to keep getting worse and worse and worse. And so I don't want to be Pollyanna-ish, but I'm hoping that the book and the sobering ground or reality, if you're paying attention to higher ed news, will help spark a bit of a conversation on, you know, I know how I think I would do it, but there might be 15 other ways of doing it. I'm not sure what is the right way of doing it. But the it is revising graduate education to meet the need of the moment and to empower our students and alums to, you know, have a variety of really interesting and successful careers. That was a long rant. I know this is something that you're very focused on as well.
Yeah, no, it's always a secret, right? The questions are always purposely naive and intentionally generative to see what comes. And listeners are interested. They're interested in obviously critics, not caretakers, and the impetus behind that. They're interested in, you know, the field at large. And without question, to my mind, the house is on fire. And I'm the furthest thing from an alarmist is you know, I spend half my time when I'm not working talking people off the ledge who are ensconced in the media about the current situation in the world. And I'm an anti-alarmist, but without question, the house is on fire. But maybe perhaps the tower is so tall that we can't quite smell the smoke from the basement. Either way, you know, there. In my own situation, I was convinced that I'd be able to get a job only because, you know, I worked hard and I, like we all do to get a PhD, but I had lots of work experience and I had a stacked portfolio and teaching administration. It's just who I am. I have a variety of interests. I was shortlisted. I mean, at University of Calgary, which is a decent religious studies program, but I was shortlisted in the first year for, you know, people from like Chicago and Harvard on their degree. So it was a solid application. Clearly, well, it wasn't about the brand name. Let's put it that way. And in each case, the job went to naturally the person who was the much clearer fit. I mean, I think in a couple of the cases, my research fit was so off from what they were looking for. It probably must have been the teaching portfolio, the application, or something about the, you know, the something about the application other than the research fit, which is why they interviewed me and at a campus visit. And, you know, the jobs went to the people who, you know, they were looking for someone for modern Hinduism, for example, or gender, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, rarely will you find someone who's looking for a scholar of Sanskrit narrative, and God forbid someone has to sort of keel over or move on. And even then they probably wouldn't renew the position. And so it wasn't a question of finding a job. It was a question of there being a job to find, there being a job to land. And it was a question of, do I want to relocate my life? You know, I started the degree in my 30s, and at this point I'm finished. Do I want to relocate for a semester, for a space or university that I'm not particularly crazy for? Do I want to sort of pursue, as I think of it, the sessional, or in America called the adjunct rat race? Do I really want that sort of life? And never in 100,000 years did I see myself working for myself or entrepreneuring. I never took a business course. That's not how my brain works. But I love teaching. I love counseling, and I can do that for myself technically as an entrepreneur. And I got great professional training as part of my degree. Well, great academic training, obviously, and great training on, you know, how to deal with the academic job market. And I would not have traded that in for anything. What would have been amazing is, here are some other things you can do with a PhD. Hey, here's the permission. Here's the permission and the validation that there are other respectable, productive paths that are beyond the professoriate proper. You know, I would probably welcome a professorship if it were a good fit, but I don't necessarily need one to produce. And I had no clue that was possible. I was hanging my head in shame for the first year or two, saying, I teach online courses. And then the pandemic hit, and I'm like, I teach online courses, because everybody's like, how do you teach online courses? But it was a really, really, really difficult path that would have been made much easier if there was space for that, these possibilities as part of my training, and just very simple strategies that I teach to anybody who will listen, who's getting a humanities PhD. So enough of the autobiography, or clearly you're not my confessor, but it's this topic is near and dear to my heart, and I never thought it would be, because I've had to engage this path. And I have colleagues all the time. I mean, I'm fairly well connected and productive in the field of Sanskrit narrative. And they're like, you know, why don't you have a job? Why don't you apply for that? You know, blah, 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 blah. I'm like, you know, have you come across somebody looking for a position in Sanskrit narrative in the last 7 years? Cause I haven't, but the world's changed. So I think in, at least now, you certainly can have a productive scholar who's not necessarily a professor in that sense, and a variety of other things one can do with their lives. But in writing the foreword for that, it's called Religious Studies Beyond the Discipline, for those listening, I'm sure we'll cover on the podcast. In writing the foreword, I think I use the terms clearly, the house is on fire, folks, because I didn't realize it was on fire during my training, and it was. And now a decade later, it hasn't gotten better by any stretch of the imagination. And I've been invited to 3 departments to speak about ways in which people can find jobs beyond the academy. But and I applaud those departments for doing so. But I'm surprised that this isn't every department that has a major focus or course on Alt-Ac Enterprise. But anyway,
like, it's great you've been invited. That's great, but that's not the solution. The solution is, your courses have to change. Your curriculum has to change. What counts? What's a dissertation? That's going to have to be revised. Do you have internships in your program? Like, all these very big curricular things. And I think the impediment here is that the faculty who will have to make these changes are themselves living and working within one set of rules, their own career progress, the next book, the next grant. We all know how that works. But they're all, you know, now we're all back to Thomas Kuhn's Structure of Scientific Revolutions, right? A book that everybody used to read. Well, they're on the edge of this paradigm shift that the people coming behind them for quite some time, by the way, that's not their parameters that they're probably going to be working in. So we have people who have tremendous inducements, incentives, pressures, how do you want to describe these? Not to engage in those adaptations because the scale of value that judges their career progress tends not to look at those things. And it's going to take, back to the E word, some entrepreneurial faculty, graduate directors, department chairs who recognize, and I hope it's not too late, climate change becomes the metaphor here, the image that by the time you know there's a problem, it might be way too late. And I'm hopeful that's not where we are. But it's going to take some very entrepreneurial people in decision-making capacities to persuade and motivate colleagues that this change has to happen without diluting the degree. I get so tired of that way of framing the issue that one wouldn't one hope that these advanced research skills you're helping students acquire get put into use in a variety of places across culture, institutions, government, NGO, corporate. You tell me where this student wants to work because they got to make decisions about their own life. That's not going to change the world, but it would certainly thicken the process by which cultural decisions, political, economic, get made in society, perhaps. Why aren't our PhDs working all across sectors in society? But it's going to take some real determination, I think, on the part of people in decision-making positions and doctoral granting departments to engage in that hard work of reinventing. There's tons of resources out there. People have been writing on this across fields, but in the study of religion, there's a bit of a silence on it so far.
Yeah, and certainly your publication will change that. And I don't think it's too late to innovate, to pivot. And I think, I mean, I vividly recall a question about in one of the talks I gave in 2020 about how can an advisor, an academic advisor, help a student along that path. And I responded, well, he or she will have been trained in a particular path their whole life and will have never left it and is now a tenured prof in that path. So it's perhaps unfair for them to guide someone from beyond that path. But what is needed is consultancy or someone from the outside to come in so that folks can gain the entrepreneurial mindset and the what is needed to innovate. That's needed at an administrative level, I believe, because not only do we not see the skills earned in a PhD doctorate applied in a variety of fields to which they're relevant, we scarcely see them applied when people want a speak. How many times do we turn the news on and someone's speaking on religion and they haven't had a semester of religious studies? All of the people who are speaking, pontificating, on religion, generally don't have religion training, and so there is a gap in terms of the application of what we do in the public sphere and in a variety of sectors, I believe. But it's going to take, I think, a change in the ethos and what we value, right? So we value online education in a way now that we certainly didn't 5 years ago. We value podcasts now. I've had over 300 guests on this podcast, more than half of whom have never been on a podcast. And many of the people who listen to this podcast in the field, they don't listen to any other podcasts. But because what is a podcast? Who knows what a podcast is, to them? But this one is a value to them because of they get to keep up with their colleagues' work, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think we're having a mindset shift in terms of the iterations of knowledge production and dissemination that we value. And it's not as if just because it's on the internet doesn't mean it has to be junk food. It could be fine dining, right? So the caliber of training need not be sacrificed for this for the sake of its application or dissemination. And I think that's a major paradigm shift that's afoot for us.
I think you're right. By the way, I think podcasts are just on-demand radio shows. Right? All those really successful radio shows easily reinvented themselves as podcasts. They just recorded the episode and put it up and called it episode one.
Fantastic. So we're close to time for today, but I thought I'd just finally ask you, was there anything else about the book, current projects, you know, anything at all that you'd like to touch on before we close for the day?
I think we've taken more than enough time of that listener who's out on a jog and can't believe they just invested 50 minutes in this. No, I'm just flattered that you wanted to talk about it. I hope the new content of the book makes it worthwhile for people who are picking it up. And it'd be interested if they too think the those old challenges that people associate with long past method and theory debates are as relevant as they ever were.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
Thank you, Raj.
For those listening, we have, of course, been speaking with Dr. Russell T. McCutcheon on the second edition of a work that is perhaps yet quite relevant, called Critics, Not Caretakers, Redescribing the Public Study of Religion. Keep well, keep reading, keep safe until next time, and keep contemplating how we study this thing called religion. Take care.